Hello and welcome to the special edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm Sarah Gon of the IRR and director of the Free Speech Union of South Africa. And herein lies the connection. My guests and I are going to discuss free speech, or rather the lack of it, in Britain. A recent addition to the Daily Friend's contributing writers is Simon Lincoln Reader, and his daily friend bio reads as follows. Simon grew up in Cape Town before moving to Johannesburg in 2001, where he was an energy entrepreneur until 2014. In South Africa, he wrote a weekly column for Business Day and then later BizNews.com. Today, he manages a fund based in London, is a trustee of an educational charity, and lives between the UK and California. Simon, welcome.
Thank you, Sarah.
Simon, we used to associate Britain with things like the Magna Carta, which was issued in 1215, that established the principle that the king and his government were not above the law. We associated with the Enlightenment, particularly Britain and France, John Locke, David Hume. And John Stuart Mill's On Liberty is probably the most influential English language philosopher in the 19th century. So we're in an area in an environment where you hear commentators talking about the British state, the British government as Stasi, Starmerism, Stalinism, and the bizarre creation of things called non-crime hate incidents, descriptions of the police, Keystone Cops, and generally referring to illiberal experiments in policing hate speech. So the situation, even from a South African perspective, seems somewhat bizarre because we actually have considerable right to free speech in this country. It's constitutionally enshrined. Simon, what exactly is happening in Britain, or not happening, as the case may be?
I think it's helpful to preface any discussion on censorship with what's been happening in America for the last 4 years, where the majority of it has come from, and where you've had Hunter Biden's laptop, then the Twitter file revelations, and then even Mark Zuckerberg's own admission that he was basically strong-armed into censoring content deemed unhelpful by law enforcement. And with the emphasis on America, a lot of people have lost sight of what's been happening in the UK that I would argue is just as bad, if not worse, because particularly in the last 4 years, the state has augmented its apparatus, its censorship apparatus, to play an outsized role in the expression of its people. And you can look to, as you mentioned, non-crime hate incidents, and the and you could look to the strengthening of Ofcom, which is the broadcast regulator. But you know, I think in terms of censorship and the monitoring of speech, no greater and more topical example exists than in the case of Alison Pearson, the Telegraph journalist.
Now, as I understand, Alison found herself having her door knocked upon by a couple of policemen on Remembrance Sunday, and essentially alleged that she actually had committed a crime in fostering hate through a tweet, a next tweet, whatever you call it, about a year ago or earlier this year, anyway, a while ago, in which she had criticized, mistakenly, a group of protesters regarding Pakistan, but she criticized them on the basis that she thought they were pro-Palestinian protesters, and the police were, as I understand it, sort of standing with them, having photographs taken of the whole event. They didn't specify what the issue was. They didn't say who had laid the complaint. They invited her to come in for an interview. Now, from what we've read from other examples of it, you know that is the sure way to see your career suddenly disappearing before your eyes. She has, there was so much hullabaloo created, the investigation has now been dropped, but this is very much Keystone Cops, went from one police department to another area. Simon, she's a well-known journalist on The Telegraph. How does something like this come to pass?
Yeah, I mean, so you're right. She was getting ready on a Sunday morning, and you know, remember, Sunday is arguably one of Britain's most sacred calendar days. And you know, it's the filth at the door. She asked them why they're there, and there was this bizarre exchange where they couldn't show her what she'd written. When she asked who the accusing party was, the police corrected her by saying it's not an accuser, it's a victim. But you know, she's no slouch, and so she put together the obvious, which is, you know, well, if it's not a crime, how can there be a victim? And this left these guys scratching their heads because they're just as confused as everyone else. You know, the irony about Alison Pearson is that she is a member of the acceptable objection establishment, meaning that she writes for an established London broadsheet, okay? This has happened. What happened to her has been happening to thousands of people since I've been counting since 2017. But they aren't what you would call the acceptable objection class. They are renegade social media profiles. And many of them have been dragged to court. The process is the punishment here. So a lot of people, and I think immediately of someone like Katie Hopkins, and now she might not be to everyone's taste, but what's happened to her is that she lost her house in the process. And you know, the guy that has done the most work, Sarah, in trying to resist this is a guy I know called Harry Miller, who runs We Are Fair Cop. And I met him back in 2017 because he had been visited by, because he reposted a limerick on social media. And a cop arrived to check his thinking, quote, check his thinking. And he ended up taking the police to court. But I remember very clearly when I met him in 2017, he said to me, when they have run out of bad guys to go after, they're going to start going after the good ones. And that's exactly what's happened here.
I mean, isn't the most egregious situation the consequences of the riots that occurred after the Southport murder of the three little girls? People did go on social media and said some pretty unpleasant things about who the origins of the perpetrator. Perhaps we'll come back to that. And said things that I would have been, shall I say, really ill-advised on immigration. Not so much what was said, but it was a very strong expression of feelings that have been percolating for a long time as a result of issues not being dealt with by the political class. And the upshot was that an extraordinary number of people got processed extraordinarily quickly and got what I think most people would commonly sense called unusually harsh punishments as a result, including imprisonment. And suddenly the whole sense of Stalinism, Stasi, the Soviet Union, and everything that implies started welling up. It is almost as if the new government had suddenly broken out and lost its whatever classically liberal instincts it might have had. And I don't think there were many, but this surely has been the most sobering consequence of the pattern you're describing.
Yes, absolutely. Look, I mean, I'm vaguely familiar with the processes that led to those rioters being jailed. And you know, it happened a couple of weeks before a BBC presenter, one of the highest paid BBC presenters, a guy called Hugh Edwards, nasty piece of work, was convicted of, quote, making the most serious class of child pornography on his phone or computer. But he was slapped with a suspended sentence, okay? And here you have these people who've been commenting, perhaps not to everyone's taste, but literally in a procession to prison, and You know, I think that there's a lot in here, Sarah. Firstly, there's this information vacuum that appears when these atrocities occur, in which the government and its law enforcement and media apparatus, supporting media apparatus, sort of try and mealy-mouth their way out of these situations. And in the case of Southport, it was by describing the alleged perpetrator as a Welshman, okay, as a Christian Welshman. Now, we know that that is not the case. And it's that gap between what people grasp of this, and, you know, there's precedent here. You only in 2017 had the Ariana Grande terror attack at the Manchester Arena, and people get very, very jumpy about these sorts of things in light of that. But the manner in which these guys were carted off to prison, whereby they were almost cajoled into accepting the offences, and then just sort of, okay, now so the judges, okay, you've got 2 years, you've got 4 years here, and then you've got the case of Hugh Edwards. This is the why there is the appearance of a two-tiered justice. But it's not just justice, is it? It's a two-tiered media. It's a two-tiered law enforcement. The appearance of these things is really bizarre. Mm.
No, I mean, I've read reports, and if they amount to anything in due course, that are most concerning is that the perpetrator of the Southport murders actually appears to not only have, if not been a practicing Muslim, then certainly having had radical Islamic information on his computer, they found that he'd manufactured ricin, which is an extraordinarily devastating poison. And reports are that while he is in prison waiting trial, he's being allowed to attend mosque. Now, that part of the outrage over that is A, some of the unwise comments about the perpetrator being perhaps a Muslim terrorist that were made during those riots may in fact be very much more true than the government has led us to believe. And the fact that nothing about this has been commented on, said, or referred to by the government then or now.
Yeah. So, I mean, it goes back to the point of this information vacuum excused with this. We don't want to prejudice the case when it gets to court. There's been a complete blackout in Parliament. You can't use privilege, which is an astonishing infraction on the established rules there. Politicians have essentially been censored from explaining what they've learned.
Sorry, I was just saying you cut out slightly there on your comment of what's happening in Parliament, or rather not happening in Parliament.
So the Speaker has essentially suspended parliamentary privilege on this issue to avoid politicians commenting on what they have subsequently learned from the attack. So there's going to be no, I mean, you say he's practicing, he's going to mosque in prison. Apparently he's got a job in prison as well. We know that the UK prisons are hugely. There is a number of Islamic extremist profiles in prisons who have an outsized influence. Until we the case comes to court, we can't talk about it. We can't do anything. But you know, there are very serious grounds. There's very serious suspicions around this from the start to where we are now.
It's kind of strange in the sense that Britain is the outlier in that very many of the elections in this year, and this year is a year packed with elections around the world, not least of which was our own in May, is that there has been a distinct shift in Europe and in America to the right. This is not in Britain because you've got the movement from completely voting the Conservative Party out of power, essentially, even though if not by in pure numerical terms, not great numbers, and voting later in. And the problem is, I think the that change were probably the same, but it was the Conservatives that people were railing against having essentially let down the Conservative project, and his voting for Labour. And I know there are some commentators who warned about the fact that Labour was being voted in almost as a protest rather than because they represented something that the British wanted to have in government. And now, as I understand it, there's a petition that's been doing the rounds to get rid of the government, which I suspect is sort of rather too late.
Yeah, I think that you're going to see a lot more of that. There's a huge dissatisfaction. And you're right in saying that the British, essentially, you can't really call it a landslide when you look at the voting technicalities. But you can, with conviction, say that it was an utter repudiation of 14 years of Conservative rule. And what's happened in those 14 years, ironically, is that those censorship, and chiefly by Ofcom, and I think you should watch this organization very closely, what it's doing, how it's being strengthened, the people that are occupying the most important roles there. I think you need to monitor that really closely in the next couple of years. But it was the Conservatives who strengthened that. It was the Conservatives who passed this online safety bill. It was the Conservatives, I'll quote from a from one of the mouths of a Conservative minister, I think earlier this year at some point before the elections, a woman called Caroline Noakes. Okay, I don't know why that woman is still a Conservative MP. She should be with the Greens or on the fringes of the left wing of the Liberal Democrats, because she told a BBC program, and obviously the BBC is, you know, but she told a BBC program that one of the competing channels should have its license withdrawn. That is a direct quote from her being interviewed. And that just captures the last 14 years of these Conservatives. They really were, they were completely ineffective on this point. But even worse, they contributed to the stifled environment where everyone is worried about what they say and the consequences to it. And, you know, bringing back to how your introductory points of the Magna Carta, this place is unrecognizable from the conditions that were outlined there. And a friend of mine wrote a book about the Magna Carta, Professor David Starkey, and he published this, I think, in 2015. And I read it again the other day because he himself has been a very victim of this of the censorship and back in 2020. And it was Keir Starmer, as leader of the opposition, who led the charge against him. So we've got in this country, I mean, I'm not an Englishman, but I happen to live here, but the conditions are set for hugely challenging obstacles in terms of freedom of speech.
There seems to be a complete lack in the Western world of muscular leadership, and which I think goes a long way to explaining Donald Trump's victory in the election. I think people want to see whatever one thinks about Donald Trump, and he's, for me, a pretty unattractive character in a whole lot of ways. He speaks with clarity in a sort of strange sense. He doesn't speak particularly well at all, but he speaks firmly, and I think that's what people want. They want a sense that somebody will say something and do it. Obviously, politicians don't always do what they will say, but there's conviction. And the only thing we seem to see largely from the Anglosphere is leadership that is pusillanimous, to say the least, is not prepared to deal with its citizenship fairly. In other words, you apply what laws the society relies upon equally to breaches of that law. I mean, Australia has just announced a complete ban on under 16-year-olds being on social media. Now, there are a whole lot of reasons why I like the idea of under 16s not being on social media, but the inhibition on free speech is surely appalling. And essentially, it's nanny statism. The Australian government is taking over the role of parents. And frankly, how do we bring back parents?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just to your point on Donald Trump, my wife used to work for him. And she feels the same. You know, he's completely mischaracterized. The guy that you see and take offense to is just not him. He's a showman and so on. He's actually a really decent man, incredibly generous with the people who've worked for him, and loyal, which is probably one of his faults. But I was reminded the other day, you know, he is very funny, and he just says what he's always like that. I think you'll see less of it in this administration. But I was reminded the other day when he was challenging for the leadership of the Republican Party for the primary in 2016. You know, he was going around on a couple of rallies. And he was called a jackass by the Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, I believe, one of the Carolinas. And Lindsey Graham had called him a jackass for whatever reason. And then in the same sort of hour had phoned him to ask for money to help him in his own campaign. And said to him that he you know, please, Mr. Trump, have a word with Fox so I could get more airtime. So Donald Trump just speaks about this freely at a campaign rally, and then he says, you know, he phoned me and he asked for money and here's his telephone number. So he gave the rally the Senator's telephone number, and Lindsey Graham had to change his mobile afterwards. And you know, I just, it's very funny. You don't get politicians who talk like that. And as I said, you're going to see a lot. I expect to see a lot less of that in this coming administration, because I think there's a lot of work to be done, and people didn't vote for a comedian this time around. They voted to reduce the cost of groceries, the cost of fuel, opportunities, and you know, I think those things will prioritize it. But Australia is a very, very worrying. You know, I think in New Zealand they have managed to claw back at some of the losses incurred under the previous administration of Jacinda Ardern. But Australia seems to be going on this a very similarly dark path to the United Kingdom. And I think there are three countries, Sarah. I think there's Canada, United Kingdom, and Australia, where there's this augmentation of state apparatus, which is making us very worried here. You know, I'm, like you, a member of the Free Speech Union. I don't use it. You know, I haven't had the need to use it yet. You know, I don't know. That might change in the next few years, because I think it's important to be critical about this government, the complete ineptitude and foreign policy decisions, domestic decisions. You know, these things are affect us. I'm a, you know, I have a company, and the budget, that speech that was made a few weeks back, is completely against profiles like myself. And you know, you have to speak out about these things, because because your children will be next. Simple as that.
Well, it seems like the current government has decided to elicit that response from the farming community, and got the backlash that one anticipated and is necessary. It's important to see people who are not the usual image of protesters coming out into the streets to protest. Simon, just to say that you've now joined the Daily Friend, our Daily Friend, as a contributor on Fridays, and your article, Becky Kicks the Hornet's Nest, which dealt with the Pretoria High School of Girls for Girls issue, racism issue, was our number one read article in October and November. So people, you know, have all the more reason to come and read the Daily Friend. Is there anywhere else from your point of view where people can go to read?
I've got time at the moment, unfortunately, just for the Daily Friend. But I think it's a wonderful initiative, and hopefully one of these alternative media platforms that will start generating more and more readership and usage, because there's a huge problem in South Africa as well. And you know, like, just to bring it, just to close that off, you know, you mentioned the Pretoria Girls School issue that seized upon by prestige media in South Africa immediately was exactly the same thing as that Irish pub in Cape Town, was exactly the same thing as Jan Brey. And you know, I'm at the point where I see these kind of activities, be they in prestige South African media or prestige UK media, as being enemy of the state and subversive. That's certainly the impression that I get, because there's absolutely no other point to documenting these incidents like that. I just think that it is hugely destructive. And you know, it's all very well that eventually when the truth emerges that these people were wrong. But you never see the editors or the owners or the managers come out to say, look, we got this one wrong. We apologize. We're going to reshape the way that we approach these stories. And I think that if people want the in-depth or the slightly satirical, slightly quirky, I think the Daily Friend is perfect for that. And hopefully it grows. Hopefully it continues to grow.
Well, the Free Speech Union here is largely about continuing to advocate for free speech and to highlight inconsistencies and egregious example that you've given. And perhaps one of the strengths of South Africa is that we have a robust civil society. We come out when we're aware of something. The ANC has tried to limit free speech and the existence of NGOs, but no effect. I think because of our past, we largely really cherish our ability to respond to what we think and to criticize. So in that respect, we are a bit of an outlier in the Free Speech Union, in the International Association of Free Speech Unions, which are England, Britain rather, New Zealand, Australia, now will soon be Canada, and is Switzerland. So to some extent, it's like, it's really watching from afar, people who should know better doing really bad things, and more power to your elbow to highlight them and help us join the fight.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a hill worth dying on, absolutely, and that's where it's going in more and more accelerated terms. And yeah, I think that you know, once you've lost this, and once you've lost the ability to speak out, then you're not really, and you just be another ward of the state, essentially. And you know, I would encourage everyone who supports your Free Speech Union, I'd encourage everyone at the Daily Friend to watch very closely the activities of Ofcom in the next few years. And you know, I agree with you. I think that by comparison, the ANC is gentle, it's tame. But when they start taking ideas from people like this, then there's a problem. So just, you know, vigilance is key.
Simon Lincoln Reader, thank you very much for joining us, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Fantastic, Sarah. Thank you so much.